Okay, so today I'm hoping it's going to be a slightly shorter lecture on the full set of equality constraints that hold for causal models. So remember, you know, what we're interested in doing here is finding, you know, for a given causal structure, what sorts of constraints are implied on the probability distributions you observe for a given probing scheme. Usually we're interested in observational probing schemes. Sometimes you have the benefit of doing some interventions. But the idea is that we can generally infer that, you know, not any old probability distribution is allowed. So when you see violations of those constraints, you can infer that certain causal structures can't explain your data. So that's why we're sort of trying to understand kind of all the constraints that are of the form of equality constraints that imply from a given causal structure. Next time we're going to be going into inequality constraints, but not this lecture. So here's an example of, you know, where you would apply these kinds of constraints. Let's say you have a theory that, you know, smoking causes cancer via tar deposits in the lungs. The tobacco companies for a long time said, well, correlation does not imply causation. So though we have observed a correlation between smoking and cancer, it could be a genetic factor that predisposes people both to smoke and to develop lung cancer. So imagine this is the tobacco company theory. Maybe they admit that there's perhaps some small amount of causal pathway here, but most of the correlation is due to this genetic factor. And you're interested in figuring out, you know, which of these is more likely to be the correct explanation. So if the genetic factor is unobserved, but the other variables are observed, so you have data on smoking behavior, cancer rates, and, you know, which people in the population have tar in their lungs or not. And suppose that your joint distribution over those three variables has this conditional independence. Smoking and cancer are correlated, but when you condition on the tar variable, you find that that decorrelates them. They become uncorrelated in every subpopulation for a given value of the tar variable. Well, this causal structure explains that, because in the chain, you expect that tar, by virtue of being a mediator between smoking and cancer, will screen them off and so it'll make them conditionally independent. But over here, you'd expect that if you, you know, learn the tar variable, generically, you'll still expect smoking and cancer to be correlated because you have that common cause. So if you see this in your data, you can say, okay, this theory's wrong. It has to be this one if these were the only two possibilities. So you would falsify this one and proceed. So this is just to give you the flavor of like how, you know, comparisons, you know, you're using your data to estimate the joint distribution, looking at the conditional independence relations and using that to rule out certain causal hypotheses. Okay, so before we get started on all this, I need to say a little bit more about interventional schemes, more than I said last time.
Yeah. Assuming no fine-tuning, right? Did you observe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was, you could, in principle, sometimes see conditional impenses that don't follow from the causal structure necessarily, but maybe for very specific parameters, you could recover that independence relation. So I'm imagining that we're not allowing this as a fine-tunings when we discard this sort of thing. I mean, maybe we'll talk more about fine-tuning in another lecture. Okay, so last time when I talked about an interventional scheme, remember we sort of had this gap in the wire of the circuit, and we said, imagine that you take the input and just measure it, and then sort of X becomes part of your output, so you've that's like an observation of X. But then for the output of this probing scheme, you randomly sample X sharp, you keep a copy, and you send the other copy back into the circuit. That was the intervention scheme we looked at last time. And I just wanted to note that, you know, let me call this split node intervention. You get sort of two copies of the variable. Your probing scheme actually gives you the values of two variables, sort of what you've measured and what you're re-preparing, the flag of what you're putting back in. Whereas often people talk about an intervention scheme that's simpler. It's more like this. You are randomly sampling and feeding something in, but then you're just ignoring whatever came into the probing scheme. You're not observing it. So we talked about an example last time of a drug, you know, whether a drug causes recovery or not. And I mentioned that, you know, if you do this split node intervention, then not only do you sort of learn whether recovery is correlated with the assigned treatment, you can also learn whether recovery is correlated with the treatment preference and find out whether there might be some common cause of the two. But generically, as I mentioned, you know, this isn't the kind of thing that we're typically interested in, to know whether people's preferences to take a drug or not are actually induced by some factor like gender that might be correlated with recovery. So often what we just do is this. We say, it doesn't matter what people, whether this person wanted to take the drug or not, we don't care. We're just going to ignore that. And we're going to do our randomized trial, and we're going to either assign them placebo or the drug and register, which we've done, and look at correlations between that and the rest. So just in terms of navigating the literature, this kind of probing scheme is what's typically meant by intervention. So from this point on, when I say intervention, I'm going to presume it's of this type. So this is a plain intervention. And if I really mean something like this, I'll call that split node intervention. Okay. So if we imagine the instrumental scenario that I've used as an example a few times, then the split node intervention, if I draw it as a DAG rather than a circuit, these DAGs are sort of a bit less expressive than circuits are, so I sort of need new ways of expressing things. So what I can do is I can split my node here, have the old X, the one I observe, and then this new X, which I'll again call X sharp, and I put it in a box to mean I'm intervening on that guy. excuse me, and you know, this is the distribution over X sharp that my randomization provides, right? So back in this picture here, there's going to be some state of knowledge about how X sharp is prepared. That gives me a distribution. So that's part of the parameters of this new model. That's in the control of the experimenter who's doing the probing scheme. Now Y doesn't depend on X anymore, it depends on X sharp here. And then what I get out is a joint distribution over four variables rather than three variables, because X and X sharp are now different. You know, this could be the preferred treatment, this could be the assigned treatment. So that's the final probability distribution. And I can now more easily learn things like, how does Y depend on its two parents? How does X depend on its two parents? Because I have X and X sharp as these two handles. Here, when I just ignore X and re-prepare it, that just corresponds to dropping the arrows into X. Here, you know, there was a version of X that had its normal parents. Here, I'm saying if I ignore the natural variable X, then basically I can drop those arrows. And now, again, I'm back to just a distribution over three variables. But now X doesn't depend on its parents in the natural experiment anymore. It's just whatever distribution I've set in this experiment. And then this is the joint distribution I get in such an experiment. Okay, excuse me. The final thing I'll mention is that often people don't necessarily describe it as a kind of randomized controlled trial. They might instead say, you as the experimenter have the power to fix the value of the thing you're intervening on. So you might draw it like this. You might say you can set the value of X sharp to whatever value you like. And so, you know, you might set it to zero for some run of experiments. You might set it to one. So rather than flipping a coin to decide, you could just, you know, probe the different values and see what happens. And similarly here, rather than generating it at random and keeping a copy, you could just set it, feed it forward, and ignore the thing. And again, in the literature, you'll often find this as the way people talk about intervention, and they sometimes use the language of fixing the value of some variable. And so if I wanted to denote that in the DAG formalism, again, you know, the circuit formalism makes it really easy to denote the difference, whether this is an input or an output. But in the DAG formalism, it's not so easy. So what often people do is they say that you do surgery on the parameters, and you say rather than stipulating what distribution of X, you just stipulate a value of X that you're setting among the parameters. So you replace the conditional probability of X given its parents with this, and then you just compute the joint distribution over all the other variables for a given value of the variable you've intervened on. So you can do that in either the split node or the plain case. Okay, so this is just to as a way of sort of I think this notion of intervention, we're going to come back to it later, but I just wanted to say a little bit more about the different notions of intervention. And for the rest of this lecture, we're mostly going to be talking about plain interventions, and they're already, you know, enough to tell you most of what you want to know about the causal model. Okay, so I want to begin with what I'll call latent-free causal models. So these are ones where there are no unobserved variables. But what I mean by that is no unobserved variables that act as common causes on many other variables. Because you remember, we had every variable could have a sort of a local noise source, a variable that's unobserved that influences it. And in the DAG formalism, we just didn't even bother to write that one down. We could have a little orange node that points into, you know, node A and another little orange node that points into node B and so on. But we typically just drop those and say, yeah, that's a given. A can depend probabilistically on its parent. So we've allowed for that. But you can't drop the latent nodes that are influencing many observed variables. And so if you consider those class of causal models where you have no such variables, that every common cause between multiple variables is actually observed, that's a situation where it's easier to do causal inference, to figure out what's going on. So we're going to start with that easy case where none of the variables are latent in that sense. And now I want to say something about sort of how to organize the different causal models in terms of what they'll exhibit under interventions. So I'm going to introduce this notion of like the behavior of a given causal structure under all possible interventions. So what I mean by that is as follows. If you consider the different possible values of parameters that you might add on to the causal model, and then you identify the tuple of distributions, so the different elements of the tuple are going to range over different subsets of all the variables. And for each subset of all the variables, you're going to look at the distribution over all the variables that arise by making an intervention just on that subset. So say I have variables A, B, and C in my causal model. I might say, all right, consider the case where I intervene on all of them. I intervene on A and B. I intervene on B and C. A and B, I intervene on just one of them or none of them. I can consider all those distributions and see what I, you know, after the intervention is done and I've kind of, you know, re-randomized a variable, what's the distribution I can get for each one of those possibilities? So that's a lot of information. You should be able to figure out everything. And sure enough, you can. In fact, we'll see later that even if there are latent variables in your causal model, you'll be able to figure out everything. And so now I can say that two causal structures are interventionally equivalent if they have the same possible behaviors, the same behaviors under all possible interventions. So this is kind of like a notion of equivalence among causal models. If they look the same under all possible interventions, you don't really want to consider them as different models. So we want to sort of figure out, first of all, what the equivalence classes of models are, and then see what the differences are between them. As we mentioned, as I said last time, you know, these latent-free causal structures, generally, if I can do enough interventions on all the variables, sort of there's no variable that I'm not allowed to do an intervention on, I can pretty much distinguish everything. So, you know, in this simple example I gave, I imagine you cut every wire and then you measure the statistics, you're going to be able to figure out what every box, as a conditional probability, every box in the diagram, you'll be able to identify it. And there's a notion of kind of one causal model being sort of more powerful than another, which I'll call interventional dominance, that I can sort of get more probability distributions under all possible interventions in one model than another. And this would be a simple example where, if I drop this arrow, I get from here to here. So out of all the parameters I can add to this model of how this guy depends on his parents, how this guy depends on him, one way that the middle guy can depend on this guy is to just have a trivial dependence. That's a subset of all the possibilities here. This guy only has that subset of possibilities in him. So I can get a lesser set of interventional distributions over here than I can here. Okay, so that's why this guy strictly dominates this guy in the order of all possible causal models. It can give me more probability distributions under observation and under intervention. So then we can say, all right, can we organize our causal models according to this equivalence? I just mentioned that sort of all the causal models without any latents. Basically, as long as they are different, right? If they're different DAGs, then they're going to be different. And now the question is, what if I only have observations, right? What if I don't have the power of intervening on the variables? And all I get to do is this passive observation where I get a copy of all these variables and I look at the distribution. What can I tell then about which models are equivalent? They give the same sets of distributions. And what can I tell about dominance? You know, which models give me strictly more observed distributions than which others? Yes?
I mean, the previous slide, so that just means that if you can remove one of the edges from these diagraphs and get to the other distribution,
yeah,
then one is stronger than the other, right?
If you can take a DAG, remove an edge, and get another DAG, then yeah, this one is above the other in the order of all the DAGs in terms of what you can achieve interventionally.
Is there a fast way to check that? Like,
Well, Marina has code for sort of figuring out, you know, if you give me all DAGs, say, without any latents of four nodes, and you want to know, okay, please organize these into a structure where, you know, one is above another, if I can remove one edge to get the other. So yeah, you can have a data structure to describe these things and figure out exactly which ones are incomparable, which ones are strictly ordered. You can do that. And I'm going to give examples later for the case of three nodes, so you'll see what it looks like. Other questions? Okay, so yeah, we're interested in just looking at observational probing schemes now and seeing what there is in terms of equivalence and dominance. And so the key result here is going to be that deseparation notion that I talked about last time. So I'm just flashing up the definition again that you saw last time. So you have a DAG with a full set of nodes V, three disjoint sets of nodes X, Y, and Z that are part of V. And then if X and Y are deseparated by Z, if and only if for every pair of vertices X and Y that you draw from each of these sets, and you look at all the paths between them, they're blocked by the set Z. And then we talked about what the definition of that path blocking property is. So there's something called the deseparation theorem, which basically says, if you have a causal structure G and three disjoint sets of variables, then whenever you see that deseparation, there's gonna be a conditional independence that holds for all the distributions that are compatible with G. So again, we saw that last time. And you know, it follows from how you know, conditioning on the mediary in a chain or conditioning on the bottom node in a fork leads to conditional independence. But it's also, you know, we saw how the local Markov condition, which was that every variable is independent of its non-descendants given its parents, that is an example of something that follows from deseparation theorem. Anyhow, all the conditional independences in your compatible distributions can be obtained from deseparation. But furthermore, if you know that some conditional independence holds in every distribution that's compatible with the DAG, then you can infer that the graph is going to have the property that X and Y are deseparated by Z. So deseparation is sound and complete for conditional independence. Now, it's true that you can sometimes have more conditional independences for some specific distributions that are compatible with G. That's like the fine tuning we're talking about. So sometimes I can have these extra independences. But those independents are not robust. They won't hold for all distributions that are compatible with the graph. They'll only hold for some of them. If you find a conditional independence that holds in all the distributions, then you know the graph has this structural property. Okay, so I'm just going to give a kind of equation version of that. If I use this notation here, it looks like my conditional independence notation, but I've put a D here, which means X is D separated from Y given Z in the graph. Then for all distributions that are in the set that is compatible with the graph, I get conditional independence. And similarly, if for all distributions I have conditional independence, then I'll see deseparation. Okay, so if we're in one of these latent-free causal structures, so all the variables are observed, then the conditional independence relations is everything there is to say. They're the only constraints on the compatible distributions, okay? And so if you go and find all the deseparation relations and then figure out what conditional independence are implied by those, you have all the constraints on your distribution. And so the proof of that is just, you know, we started off last time by saying look, all the distributions that are compatible with the DAG are just this big product of every variable given its parents. This, you know, so I just multiply for every variable given its parents, multiply those conditional probabilities. That gives me the joint distribution over the whole graph. I showed you guys how that set of distributions can also be characterized as the ones that satisfy this local Markov condition. So every variable independent of its non-descendants given its parents, and conditional dependencies that follow from those guys and the semigraphoid axioms. So that's the same set of distributions. But now it's also true that all the conditional dependencies that we had here are equivalent to the ones that you obtain by going and finding the deseparation relations in the graph. And so all of these are characterizations of the full set of distributions that are compatible with a latent free causal model. Good, so then I want to show you just what this means for some simple examples. So the simplest would be just a two-node latent-free DAG, very trivial. There's only two DAGs I can write down for two nodes. And obviously they're different interventionally, right? You know, this guy has correlations if I intervene on him. This guy doesn't have correlations. So, you know, there's this dominance order interventionally. I can get all distributions over this pair. I only ever get factorizing distributions over this pair. So obviously, you know, the case where the parameters here are chosen such that this guy does not depend on his parent simulates this, but I can't go vice versa, so it's a strict ordering. And then if I ask, what about observationally? Well, yeah, I can get correlated distributions here. I can only get uncorrelated distributions here. So they're different, they're not observationally equivalent, and there's a strict dominance. I can, of course, simulate all the distributions I see here by, again, making that dependence trivial, okay? So this is easy. What about the case of three-node latent-free DAGs? Now you have six different possibilities. Here they are. You know, we've seen a bunch of them already, the collider, the chain, the fork. This DAG up here, where I have essentially a chain and then one that goes from the bottom node to the top, that's, I'll call that the saturating class, because observationally you can get all distributions over the three variables using this causal structure. And then there's some more trivial ones where like one of the nodes factorizes from the other two, or all three factorize. And that's it. These are just all the DAGs. I should mention that, of course, if I put labels on these guys like A, B, and C, and I sort of am doing a measurement of a distribution on A, B, C, like say here, well, then it makes a difference whether the labels are A, B, C, in which case I expect A and B to be independent in the collider, or if it's A, B, C, then I expect A and C to be dependent. So what I'm really representing here are sort of the whole class of causal models under permutations of the labels, because ultimately you're going to be comparing your data with a given model and a particular choice of labeling of those nodes. But the set of distributions that that DAG generates, you know, I can easily get from one labeling to another just by, you know, permuting the variables in the set of constraints. So what really matters is the set of distributions that each one of these can generate observationally or interventionally. Okay, so you can ask now, all right, well, what's the order between these? And it's not hard to see that it's got to be this kind of order, because the collider, for example, can be obtained by making this causal dependence here trivial. The chain is obtained by making this dependence trivial. The fork is obtained by making this dependence trivial. So they're clearly strictly below. But if you look at pairs here, there's no way of manipulating this guy to get here. Like, there's no arrow dropping that'll get me. So these guys are incomparable. It means that no one of them can simulate the interventional distributions of the others. But all of them can simulate this guy, because I can always find some causal dependence to make trivial to generate this. And so they're sort of back on the same path. And of course, this can generate this by making that trivial. So that's the interventional ordering, the dominance order among these guys. And now if I say, what about observationally? I finally get something a little bit interesting, which is that these guys here, which were distinguishable by in an interventional sense, right? So remember, you know, if I intervene on B, for example, that asks me to drop all the influences into B and replace them by just, you know, some fixing of the value of B. Well, then I'll see that B and C are correlated, but, you know, C is no longer correlated with A. Whereas over here, if I intervene on B, I can still see correlation between B and C. So they're interventionally different. But observationally, they're exactly the same, because the only constraint they imply on the joint distribution is the conditional independence of A and C given B. And we just saw that that's the only constraint that holds for these latent free DAGs. So these two causal structures give exactly the same observed probability distributions. And so if all you're doing is passive observation, and you see a distribution that satisfies this, and you think that there's no fine-tuning going on, then you can say, well, it's one of these two, but I don't know which. There's going to be some ambiguity about what's going on causally. Okay, but I mean, you preserve the old order because if I considered the set of distributions I could observe in this causal structure here, that's all of them, so there's no conditional independence relations in this set, just any distribution you can write down over three variables, it can be generated in this causal structure. But I can also generate any distribution that's compatible with this guy because, you know, among these distributions are the ones where, where B depends trivially on A. And so I can simulate, I mean, I shouldn't have put labels here. So sorry, these labels shouldn't be here. But I can simulate the collider within this guy by making the head of the collider identified with this one and just dropping this arrow. So all the observed distributions I can get here, obviously I can get there as well. But it's a strict difference because I can violate the independence of A and C up here. And so there's more distributions that I could possibly observe. So the old order, the interventional order, persists. So you know, things that are strictly ordered might become observationally equivalent, but you're never going to have like a reversal. You're never going to find that suddenly on the observational side, you know, this one can explain more than another one. Okay, so in this case, we found that these two things that were interventionally incomparable have now become observationally equivalent. Should I say anything else about this? I guess it's clear what all the independence relations should be. You know, here everything's independent of everything else. So A is independent of the set B and C, B is independent of the set A, C, et cetera. Here C is independent of the set A and B. And then, yeah, we talked about it, these other guys. Good. So one way you could draw this, if you just sort of wanted to focus on the dominance order for observations, is sort of these guys go into one equivalence class, which I could draw as one big box like this, and call it the sort of chain and fork class, which has this independence relation. And so now every one of these five different boxes is characterizing a different set of distributions on a triple of variables, right? And it's the only distinctions that arise for three-node latent-free causal models. But I'm actually going to tend to draw things this way, just because this diagram kind of captures all the information. It tells me about the interventional incomparability of these guys, but the coloring also tells me about what's observation equivalent. So it sort of has all the information. And so I like drawing things this way, just so that it's sort of clear what's going on. Okay. As I said, you can just if you have this kind of classification, you can then look at the conditional independences in your data and see what sorts of explanations could potentially do justice to it. And typically, if I see some independences, then everything above it in the order could still do justice to it. It's just using more causal connections than you strictly need to explain your data. So typically, people prefer the sort of lowest explanation in the order that can do justice to your data. Okay, I tried to draw out some similar structures for the four observed variables, but I got tired of doing it. So anyways, this is a kind of incomplete graph, but and I don't think this is even all of them. There are 31 in all, and you can work out, and you have more incomparability and more numbers of levels in that partial order. Okay, so that's just a sort of classification project. In the winter school this year, we worked a lot on, so Katie was in the winter school, we thought a lot about classifications of causal structures. We saw that three-node example. But if you go to 4 nodes, 5 nodes, 100 nodes, that you have no hope of classifying those guys. I mostly present the classification because I find it useful to sort of know the landscape. Say, if I knew everything, this is the kind of thing I would know. But generally, especially in certain contexts where you have a lot of variables, what you'd rather have is something like an algorithm that says, all right, I tell it what conditional independences I found among my variables in the data, and then the algorithm tells me what the possible causal explanations are. So if I'm confident that there are no unobserved variables, and I say I think it's a latent free DAG that explains my data, but which ones could it be? So if I've, you know, in the simplest case where I have three variables and I see a conditional independence, A is independent of B given C, and I say, all right, well, what are the feasible latent free DAGs? The algorithm should say the chain and the fork. Those are the options. Whereas others, it might be, oh, it's got to be this one. This is the only DAG that has those conditions. And you know, if there's many variables, it could be there's a set of 10 of them that could explain your data. So there are some algorithms like that. So in Perl's book on causality and other textbooks, there were sort of two algorithms that were developed at the same time independently called ICSTAR and then the PC algorithm. And they essentially do this. They encode this sort of no fine-tuning assumption, and they basically have a way of encoding the set of all latent-free DAGs that could explain a given set of conditional independences. Okay. So before getting on to the case of where we allow for latents, I want to say a little bit about what you can do using some more kind of coarse grain notions rather than the whole probability distribution. You might want to encode, you know, what you've observed in a more coarse grained way in terms of like entropies of things, mutual information, things like that. So just say a couple of words about that. So if you've done any information theory, you'll probably recognize the expression for the Shannon entropy. So it's just the sum for a variable x, the Shannon entropy for a variable, random variable x is the sum over the values of the weighted probability of the logs of the probabilities, negative of that. And it quantifies something about how, you know, how much uncertainty there is that distribution is describing. So a uniform distribution has a high entropy, a distribution that's very narrow or a point distribution has zero entropy. And I can then, if I have multiple variables, I can look at the joint entropy between a pair of variables, and there I just plug in the joint distributions here and I calculate the uncertainty I have about that pair of variables. And then using the difference between the uncertainty between x and y and just the uncertainty on y, I can have a kind of conditional entropy. So, you know, how much uncertainty do I have about x when I know y and then average over y? The mutual information tells me about something about how much x and y are correlated. How much would I learn about y if I came to know x. So it's defined this way, the sums of the individual entropies minus the joint entropy. And then finally, there's a conditional mutual information, which roughly speaking tells me how much I would learn about y when I learn something about x when I already know the value of z. And it allows me to quantify this just by, you know, one real number. So remember we gave the definition on the day two, I think it was, of marginal independence between a pair of variables. And I said, look, there's lots of ways of writing it down in terms of conditional probabilities. Well, I can also write it down in terms of mutual information, right? So it's basically, if A and B are marginally independent, it means the mutual information between them is zero. They're not correlated at all. So if you haven't seen the proof of this before, it's pretty straightforward. It just follows from the definition. So this is the entropy of the joint distribution on the pair of variables. But if they're marginally independent, that factorizes. So I can just plug it in. So if I plug in the product distribution, well, the log of the product becomes the sum. And now I distribute the sum over the two terms. And I notice that in the first term, for example, I have a sum over A, PA, log PA, and then just a sum over B, P of B. But that just gives me one, because these distributions are normalized. And similarly with the second term, the sum over A will disappear. So I get this. But that, of course, is just the entropies for HA and HB. So in the case of a factorizing distribution, the joint entropy is the sums of the individual entropies. And because of the definition of the mutual information, that means that it's got to be zero in that case. So if I don't, if it's burdensome to keep track of the whole distribution, check for factorization, one thing I can do is just, you know, compute the mutual information to test for independence. And the same thing is true for conditional independence. So we had seen these different definitions of A and B being conditionally independent given C, but I can also define it equivalently in terms of the conditional mutual information between those being zero. And again, the proof is pretty straightforward. It just follows from the definitions. I'm not going to go through it. But I will make one final comment, which is that you can, you know, find these nice relationships among entropies and mutual informations. So for instance, you can derive that the mutual information between X and Y, so when the conditional mutual information is zero, the mutual information between X and Y is bounded by the entropy of Z. And that can be a useful tool for testing hypotheses. Like rather than testing directly for conditional independence, you can ask questions like, is the amount of correlation between X and Y explainable by the amount of randomness in Z? So a simple example would be something like, if Z is a bit and X and Y are both three valued, then this causal structure cannot generate a perfect correlation between two three-valued variables using just one bit of shared randomness. And this would detect that. It would say, okay, well, the entropy of my random bit is just one, but the mutual information between X and Y is greater than one, so there's no way that I can explain that. Now, it's not saying anything more than what was already said here, but it's just that it's sometimes perhaps easier or might be useful to think about it in this kind of way. I should mention that you know, if Z was not observed, if it was latent, but I had some promise on how many values it has. I have a promise on its cardinality, right? So if I knew Z was a bit, but I wasn't observing it, I could still say, well, I know that that entropy can't be bigger than one. And so if I observe a mutual information between X and Y that's greater than one, I could say, well, even though I'm not able to test for conditional independence because I don't have access to Z, nonetheless, I can see that, you know, because of what I know about Z and how much cardinality it has, I could rule out the possibility of this being the causal structure. So there's a lot of tricks like that where you can also look at things like the what's called the non-negative rank of the joint distribution over X and Y. That's going to be bounded by the cardinality of Z. So you can sometimes figure out what's going on causally by looking at entropies or other measures of correlations, rather than looking at the whole joint distribution. Okay, on to the case of causal models that now are not necessarily latent-free. And I'm just going to call them latent-permitting because I want to sort of imagine the class that sort of includes the latent-free ones now. So it's going to be latent-free plus all the ones that have some latents, just because it's a nicer mathematical object to look at. Okay, so first of all, there's a caveat, which is much of what I'm going to say has made an assumption that hasn't been made explicit up till now, which is that the cardinality of those latent variables is typically taken to be unrestricted, that it can be arbitrarily large. So back in lecture one, when I talked about, you know, the Bell causal structure, and I said, all right, this is what it looks like with some lambda, and now you vary over the parameters. You know, in the context of discussions of Bell's theorem, where we say, oh, this is how we should think about a local hidden variable model, we allow the hidden variable lambda to be anything you like. We're, you know, extremely permissive. We're like, yeah, it doesn't have to be a bit. It could be 100 valued. It could be continuous. It's whatever you want. There's no restriction on the nature of lambda. So yeah, in the causal modeling context, we're going to follow that kind of rule and say that lambda, this latent variable, is of arbitrary cardinality, and we want to know what constraints follow on the distribution over the observed variables when we make that permissive assumption about the latent ones. So similarly, you know, in lecture one, I showed you the triangle scenario. Same deal. You want to take lambda, omega, gamma, let them all be arbitrarily large cardinality, and ask, even under that permissive assumption, you know, I want to know what are all the possible joint distributions that follow from that causal structure. And so that's not to say that there isn't some interesting problems with, you know, what if you did know the cardinalities of those latent variables? You know, so I mentioned a few minutes ago that sometimes you can make progress just knowing the cardinality without observing it necessarily. And actually, in April, we're going to have a workshop here that brings together quantum physicists and causal inference people. And one of the focuses of that workshop is trying to make progress on this case of like, it's a latent variable model, but there's a restriction on the cardinality. What can you say? There's some stuff known about it, but I think there's, yeah, a lot of interesting stuff that could be done. But for us, we're just going to stick to the conventional, the one that's conventional in the causal modeling literature. So it's not only the conventional one in discussions of local hidden variable models in quantum theory, but in the causal inference literature, people tend to do this. They tend to assume that those latents have arbitrary cardinality. Okay, so now let's revisit this notion of interventional equivalence classes, but now for these latent permitting causal models. So remember that, you know, we had these behaviors under all possible interventions, and now the only restriction is going to be, you know, we're doing these event interventions on the observed variables, not the latent ones. So the latent ones, were the whole assumption is that we're not going to imagine that we can get in and either observe or intervene on them. They're something that we don't have access to in our probing schemes. But we can still ask, if I've done all possible interventions on the other variables, the ones that are observed, you know, can I tell two models apart? That's the kind of thing I want to know. And so if two latent permitting causal structures have exactly the same behaviors, you know, observationally under every possible intervention on subsets of variables, then we'll say that they're interventionally equivalent. Okay, so, you know, again, a simple example. If I have the case here of a directed edge and a latent common cause acting on these two guys, then that has a different interventional behavior than just the directed edge. Observationally, these are the same, of course, because they can both of these can generate all the correlated distributions on these two variables, right? If I have just a cause-effect relation, I can sample, let's call this A and B, I can sample any distribution array, and then I can make the causal dependence any conditional B given A, and so I can get any joint on AB just by choosing my parameters that way, okay? And I can also do it here, I can get any joint over AB. But if I ask about... Okay. If I ask about interventions now, there is a difference, which is for a given choice of the parameters in the model, if I intervene on A here, that means I have to drop this arrow, right? I drop all arrows into a variable when I intervene on them. And so now for a given choice of parameters, I'm going to be able to see the difference between what I've observed, what I would have in the observational scheme for those parameters, and what I have in the interventional scheme. So it could be that over here, you know, in the observational case, I see stronger correlations than when I intervene and I drop this arrow. And so that difference doesn't arise here. Here, the observational correlations and the interventional correlations are exactly the same because there are no arrows into it. So observation and intervention on A give me exactly the same thing. So you can tell these guys apart if you have all this information about the different possible ways you could probe them. And so there's going to be a strict dominance. But there are going to be certain examples that are equivalent. And so let me spend some time talking about those. There's before I get onto the non-trivial ones, there's some trivial examples, like if I have A and B, and I, instead of having a direct arrow between them, they have an influence through some latent variable, some C that I haven't observed. Well, remember that the latents are allowed to have arbitrary cardinality. So that doesn't change anything. If I say, oh, A influences some variable C and then C influences B, well, that's just the same as allowing an arbitrary conditional probability of B on A. So, you know, throwing in latent variables between two other variables doesn't do anything. Throwing in a sort of chain of latent variables one after another, that doesn't do anything. I can lump those together. Putting in a latent variable as a terminal node that has no children does nothing because I'm not observing it. It's not correlating anything else. So there's a lot of sort of latent variables that you can immediately discard because they're not, you know, changing anything about the correlations or the interventional distributions on the observed variables. And then I would say there's a sort of a few less obvious equivalences. And so let me go through them. So something like this, where I have a latent that's on the way, but it's on the way not between a pair of variables, between one variable and some set of others. So in this example, there's just two others. So it turns out that is equivalent to the situation where I've dropped the arrow from B into the latent, replaced it with arrows directly from B to each of the children of that latent variable. So now I have arrows here and here. And now made this variable have no parents at all. So this is called exogenization because it means that the latent variable has been made to have no parents, and that's sometimes called exogenous in this context. It's got no parents in the model, so it's exogenous. So I can take a latent variable like this one, make it exogenous if I compensate by adding these arrows here. Okay, so why is that interventionally equivalent? Well, a nice way to see it is to imagine that you've got some circuit, so I'm going to use the circuit notation now, where B might be output from some other stuff, A and C are being input into other things, and this is just a little fragment inside that circuit. And there's this lambda, that's my latent variable, which I'm not intervening on or measuring or observing. And it's being copied between these two guys. So I want to show that that is equivalent interventionally to this one here, where B now gets copied. So this is what the direct arrow from B to A and C would look like in the circuit model. And now I have a common cause of just these two guys, which is latent. That's my gamma here. So I want to show that those are equivalent with respect to interventions on the observed stuff. So that's B, A, and C. And so actually, any interventions on B, A, and C sort of happen after here and here and before here. So really, if I can just show that these two circuit fragments are the same, then I will have shown this interventional equivalence. So that's not hard to do. Let's go through it. So how do I show that I can go from here back to here? Well, I can sort of move this dot forward. So I've just slid this copy operation forward. So I imagine kind of doing the sampling of gamma earlier on. And now think of lambda as just the pair of B and gamma. Remember, lambda, like every latent variable, can have unlimited cardinality. So if I want to encode B in it, I can. That's fine. So lambda is now B and gamma. And now this is just the preparation of lambda given B. That's a way of processing B into lambda. It's fine. And so I can parse this diagram as an instance of this diagram. So obviously that way is fine. And the other way is a bit trickier, but also straightforward. So remember that any conditional dependence, lambda given B, is ultimately a deterministic dependence with some extra variable, which I'll call gamma here, that's distributed in some way. And then you just need to know that a deterministic dependence goes through a copy operation, right? So if I have some deterministic function from B to lambda, and then I copy lambda, well, I may as well just copy the input and apply the function to every one of the copies of the input, right? It's a deterministic function. So it doesn't matter whether I copy the input and apply the function, or apply the function and copy its outputs. I'm going to get the same result. So that means I can move this deterministic function through this dot. And so think of gamma and B again as one system. I move it through the dot. And so what I mean is I have to copy B and gamma. Each of them gets copied. And I do this function separately on each of the copies. But now I'm just going to box that function together with this thing and box this together with that. And now notice that these guys are separated. So I get this diagram. I'm just copying B and I'm preparing some gamma and giving a copy to each of these guys. So I've proven it's of that form. So from the perspective of interventions on B, A, and C, these two things are exactly the same. And so I can always exogenize any latent variables, which means that there will be no more latent variables that appear on the way between observed variables anymore. I already mentioned there's no sort of variables that are terminal, that have no children, and are latent. And now there's no mediary. So all the latent variables in these latent permitting models are going to appear as common causes of a bunch of others. That's the only non-trivial way in which they appear. Okay. And then there's a second rule, which says that if I have something like a common cause of some set that's latent, and another latent common cause of some subset of that set. So in this example, the first set is ABC, the subset is AB. Well, that's interventionally equivalent to just having the common cause of the full set. So again, not hard to show. I'll do it with the circuits. So imagine this is a little circuit fragment that's attached to some other stuff. This is the case where I have a common cause on these two and all three. This is a case where I just have the common cause on all three. This, of course, is going to rely on the cardinalities of these things being arbitrary. The point is I can pull this whole thing back and just consider gamma and omega together to be the common cause. And I could just have this party here ignore that third, like I can make three copies of gamma rather than two copies, and just have him ignore that copy. And so obviously, if this is the causal structure, I can simulate that by just having the third party ignore their share of gamma. And obviously I can sort of go from here to here because I could just have these guys ignore their shares of this, and that's just a three-way cause. So it means that you can associate your pattern of latent common causes with what's called an abstract simplicial complex. All that really matters are sort of the subsets of variables that are influenced. I don't need to tell you that there's a three-way common cause and some two-way common causes among them. So this is a nice way of doing it. You say, if you have a finite set V of variables, and now this B is a set of subsets of V that have the following constraint, that if T is a subset of variables and T is part of my simplicial complex, then every subset of variables within T is also part of my simplicial complex. So if ABC set is inside my simplicial complex, then the subset AB is, and so is the subset BC and AC and the singletons A and so on. They're all in there. So a simplicial complex is the right way to describe the common cause structure in your latent permitting DAG. And so Robin Evans defined a notion which he called an MDAG, which is now a pair, a directed latent free DAG. So this is just a bunch of nodes with directed edges between them, and a simplicial complex, which tells you the pattern of common causes that act among those nodes. And these are the interventional equivalence classes of the latent permitting DAGs. So here would be an example. If I draw a DAG with some latent variables that are acting on common causes of others, all that matters is the full set that they act on. So I've put no extra common causes between A and C or anything like that. And so ultimately, what matters are the subsets. So A, C, and E are a subset of variables that are acted on by one common cause. So I can think of a way of depicting that where I have my directed graph, which is the directed edges here, and then I draw my simplicial complex as just a set of hyper edges, right? So this you can think of as a hyper edge, which is now a set of nodes that can have more than two nodes in it, and it's an undirected kind of edge. It just connects up a bunch of nodes. So there's, here there's two hyper edges. There's a common cause of B and D, and there's a common cause of A, C, and E. And the important thing is that, these hyper edges should not include any sort of smaller hyper edges within them. I don't have to represent those. So here's another example, right? If I drew it this way as a DAG, where these three guys were latent, then if I replace those latents by just hyper edges that describe which nodes are connected by a common cause, it cleans things up considerably. I find it a lot easier to sort of see what's going on in this picture than in this picture. It's sort of clear where the directed causal influences between the observed variables are and where the common causes are acting. So I'm going to lean heavily on this kind of notation in the next little bit. So now let's, again, just to kind of get some intuitions for how this all works, let's go back to understanding some simple examples, classifying simple examples. So when do I have strict dominance with respect to interventions? Well, it's still the case that if I drop a directed edge in the directed part of the graph, I'm going to have dominance. So here's an example. These are both MDAGs. And if I drop this edge here, I'm going to get this guy. Well, that's going to be interventionally dominating this one because, for these two guys, it makes a difference. My interventions on him here can lead to correlations, whereas here, if I intervene on this guy, it's going to drop arrows from the common cause, and so there'll be no correlations. Whereas in the observational case, I'll see correlations between this pair of nodes and this pair of nodes. So there's going to be a difference between these guys. So it's just like we had before in the latent free case. Dropping a directed edge is going to lead to a strict dominance. It's going to mean you can get strictly more in one than the other. But it's also the case that if you, reduce the action of the power of the common causes, you'll get a strict dominance as well. There, things are different. We're not going to drop a hyper edge. We're going to move downwards in the order of these simplicial complexes. So here's a hyperedge of, on all three nodes. And this is one where I have sort of three hyperedges that just pick out the pairs of nodes. So that's kind of one step down. You can see why this corresponds to an interventional dominance simply if I redraw it as a DAG with latent variables. So this you should think of as representing a three-way common cause, which of course includes two-way common causes as special cases. But if I now drop just this arrow, I'm left with two-way common causes here, here, and here. Of course, I just have one big two-way common cause because these things are arbitrary cardinality, so I can lump them together. So I'm left with this, which is just this structure. So when we're kind of, we just lean on that old result that, you know, dropping an arrow in a directed graph leads to interventional dominance typically, then I use that to show that, okay, this reduction in the space of simplicial complexes is also a rule for dominance under interventions. Okay, so there's lots of examples here where, you know, if I took this guy and I dropped arrows and I replaced certain hyperedges with you know, sets of hyperedges that are below it in that order over complexes, I could start to see what that order looks like. So let's go back to our two and three node examples, but now with these latent variables. So there's only two directed structures among two nodes, and there's only two simplicial complexes, the one where each one is in its own hyperedge and one where they have a common cause, so in the same hyperedge. So I can say, all right, let's just combine the different patterns of directed structures and the different patterns of simplicial complexes, and this is what you get. So you have the case where there's a cause-effect relation and a common cause, the case where there's just a cause-effect relation, the case where there's just a common cause, and the case where they're factorizing. And it's very easy to know what the dominance order is because you have dominance here, dominance there. So obviously this is the dominance. If I drop the hyperedge I get from here to here, if I drop the directed, so dropping the directed edge means that there's a strict dominance here and here. Dropping the hyperedge means there's a strict dominance here and here. Good. So this here, you know, these guys are interventionally inequivalent, but observationally the same, not observationally the same. They're interventionally incomparable is what I want to say. When I ask about observation, I find that all three of these guys are equivalent. They can all generate every distribution over the pair of variables, right? So if I don't have access to interventions, only observations, I can not tell which of these three guys I have. I can tell them apart from him, though, because this is only the uncorrelated distributions. Okay, so if I want, I could draw it like this, but this is a bit more informative. So now let's go to three node DAGs. This is the first time it gets non-trivial. So remember what the directed structures look like. We saw this before. There was only six of them. These are the six directed structures over three nodes. And I'm just going to redraw them now to make things a little bit easier, just to be consistent with some of my other drawings. So I've just sort of laid them out as a triangle with the different arrow patterns. This is still the collider, the fork, the chain. These are the possible simplicial complexes over three nodes, all in the same hyperedge, you know, every pair in a hyperedge. And now I start dropping, you know, one pair does not have a hyperedge, two pairs do not have a hyperedge, and then there's no hyperedges at all. So all I need to do now is consider how to combine these simplicial complex structures with these directed edge structures to get all the structures. So let's see what happens if I say, all right, what are all the ways of combining, say, this directed edge structure with this, with these different simplicial complexes? And the answer is this, that, you know, over for this edge, there's only one way to combine them. Similarly here, because of symmetry, here there becomes three ways, right? The directed edge could be part of one of the two, one of the two hyperedges, and the other hyperedge attaches to its head. Here, the other hyperedge attaches to its tail. Here, the directed edge is between the two nodes that are not connected by a hyperedge, and they're all different. And similarly, over here, I can have this three ways of connecting the directed structure to the simplicial complex. So anyways, you can do this for every directed edge. So here's, you know, the chain, ask all the ways of combining, and you always get a similar story. In the case of the chain, you only have one way of combining it with these simplicial complexes, but three ways of combining it with those guys. For others, you only have two ways of combining it. It kind of depends on the symmetries. But at the end of the day, you get something that looks like this. So this is my hand-drawn version of it. Here I have sort of these islands, six islands, which correspond to the six directed structures. And within each island, I have the different ways of combining the simplicial complex with a given directed edge structure. So the guys I showed you were this set and this set here with the chain. And you can write out exactly what the interventional dominance order is because you know exactly what happens when you drop a directed edge, where you get to, you know, you're moving down in this structure when you drop a directed edge. When you reduce in the simplicial complex, you're moving through this structure. So that means you're moving downwards in each one of these islands here. So this is the full structure for three node MDAGs of this interventional dominance order. And it's very easy to just code this up. And Marina has code that does this kind of thing that'll tell you exactly what the order relation between all these guys is. The harder thing is to ask, well, which one of these are observationally equivalent? Which ones can we not tell apart from observations? All right, so I'm going to show you the answer, but I'm not going to be able to show you all the techniques that lead to this answer. But here I've just color-coded all the ones that are observationally equivalent. So you'll see a lot are in green. Those are the ones that give you all distributions. And then you have a set of blue ones here. They span multiple islands, so all the blue ones in these different islands all give the same set of observed distributions. Similarly with the red ones, the light blue. There's a yellow here by itself, a light green, orange. And that's it. There's all purple here. These are all the classes. So now let me pull them out. And they look like this. So when we had the latent free guys, we had the factorizing distributions, the one that sort of two were correlated and the other factorized. We had the collider, we had the chain of the fork, and we had the saturating class. And now we have three new classes. So adding those latent variables has given us three new things that are observationally inequivalent to the ones we had before. And they sort of sit here between these two classes. So what do they look like? Well, let me tell you first about the boring ones, right? The saturating class had this latent free saturating guy, but it has lots of others as well. So the one where I have a common cause of all three, that's also in the saturating class. And actually most of them, there's like 21 others where I have combinations, like, you know, any directed edge pattern with this hyper edge obviously is saturating. Any directed edge hyper edge pattern together with this causal structure is saturating. And, you know, causal structures that have a few less edges, but that's compensated for by hyper edges, they're saturating too. So most of the guys fall here. The factorizing class still just is this one here with no directed edges and no hyper edges. Over here, the two that are correlated can be correlated in these three possible ways. In the chain and fork, I have my fork, I have my chain, but I can also throw in certain common causes between like the two bottom elements of the chain or one side of the fork, and I maintain exactly the same set of observed distributions. I could also drop one of the edges in the fork and I still have the same set of distributions. The collider, same story. I can have the one without any latents, but there's a bunch of ones with latents that give me exactly just the independence between the two bottom nodes of the collider. And then these are the three interesting ones. The triangle, these three MDAGs, which are, this is the one that we've looked at before and called the instrumental scenario. So this is really the class of the instrumental scenario. And then there's this one. So let me redraw those now back as DAGs with certain latent variables. So we already saw this in the first lecture, the triangle, the instrumental, that was the beginning of the first lecture. And then there's this one, which is the only other interesting one that has three observed nodes on it. So the classification project immediately gives you some interesting things to look at. These guys are not distinguished from the others based on equality constraints, right? So all of these ones here had different patterns of conditional independences. These guys here, they all have the same conditional independences as the saturating class, namely no conditional independences. And so the thing that distinguishes them is they have inequality constraints. And I'll explain at some point, maybe next time, maybe the lecture after, why it's only the inequality constraints that can possibly be violated quantumly. So these are the ones that are particularly interesting from a quantum perspective. So that's why, you know, there's been work done on if you replace this common cause with a quantum source, can you violate some of these inequalities and prove, you know, witness the quantumness of that source? Yes, we know that that's true. Over here, I also mentioned in the first lecture, we know it's true that if I replace one or more of these sources with quantum sources, I can violate some of the classical inequalities, and so witness the quantumness of those sources. So it's an interesting fact that we still don't have the answer for this one. Nobody knows yet whether it is possible to find a quantum violation. If there's a gap between the correlations you get when these are quantum sources and the ones you get when they're classical sources. In this, the sort of, along with these two, it's the most simple example you can come up with. Even the Bell scenario has four observed variables in it, so it's a bit more complicated than these guys. So that's an interesting fact, and in the winter school 2 years ago, we worked on trying to settle that and discovered it. It's a hard problem that lots of people have thought about now, and we haven't seen our way to do it. Okay, so let me end with what happens to the I think there's two more topics. This one's quick, and then I'll end on nested Markov conditions. The deseparation theorem, what happens when you allow for latent variables? So obviously, if you're interested in conditional independence relations, you're only interested in conditional independence relations for the things you observed, because you want to go look for it in the probability distribution over the observed variables. So we're not talking about deseparation among latent variables, we're talking about deseparation relations among the observed variables. So if you've got a big DAG, you might still have some interesting deseparation relations among the observed variables. And so the question is, does that deseparation theorem go through when you throw in latent variables? And the answer is, it does. So if you have a causal structure G that now allows for some latents, and you got your three disjoint subsets X, Y, and Z, then it's still true that if you see deseparation in your graph between them, then all probability distributions that are compatible with that graph will have that conditional independence. The compatible distributions now could involve inequality constraints and so on, but they will still satisfy all the conditional independence relations that are implied by deseparation. And the completeness result still holds, that if all your compatible distributions satisfy conditional independence, then the graph has to have that structure in it. So let me try to show you intuitively why that's the case. Here's the example we saw last time. So last time I didn't bother to sort of try to write out explicitly all the paths from X to Y. I thought it would be useful to do that. I think I have them all here. And I think I realized that something I said last time was probably wrong. I think I said last time that you could condition on H or something like that to get a deseparation with X and Y. But H actually is a collider on this path. So if I condition on H, but J continues to block that path. Anyways, oh, it's a collider here. That's a problem, right? So if I condition on H, I would open up this path here, and that would be a problem. But what you can show is that if I condition on G and A, then all of these paths are blocked. So if you look, so here, you know, you're not conditioning on K. K is a collider, so this path is blocked. You're not conditioning on J. It's not in the set of G and A, so this path is blocked. You're conditioning on G, so that blocks correlations between X and Y in this path. You're conditioning on A, which is at the base of a fork, so that blocks this path. Here, there's lots of ways of blocking it, A and G. Here, G still blocks it. Here, A still blocks it. So anyways, all the paths are blocked, so you know G and A do deseparate X from Y in this case. And now the point is simply that it really didn't matter whether the other variables besides G and A were observed or latent. Because we're assuming that we're not conditioning on them. So, you know, for all the colliders, we're not conditioning on them. So if I tell you, oh, it's actually latent, you haven't even measured it at all, then clearly you're not going to unblock paths associated with that guy. So that's the result. That basically, it doesn't matter. You know, the set you're conditioning on is observed. Everything else could be latent, which means a whole bunch of variables in your DAG could be latent. The deseparation result is still going to go through. And so in particular, you can apply these old algorithms. You get your set of conditional independence relations, say, among your observed variables. You can still find the latent free DAGs that have the right deseparation relations. But of course, those DAGs might not actually explain your data. They might not be able to satisfy, you know, inequalities that are actually, all you're going to find from the conditional independence relations is what you can infer from them alone, but not what you can infer from the stronger information of whether you violated certain inequalities or not. So, you know, maybe my example will make this clear, that if I give you some distributions that come from a quantum Bell experiment, they violate Bell inequalities, they still have a certain pattern of conditional independence relations that have nothing to do with the inequalities. And you could plug those conditional independence relations into these algorithms, and what those algorithms would spit out would be the classical Bell model with the classical common cause, because all those algorithms are saying are what sorts of models could explain the conditional independence relations in your data. And the classical Bell model can do that. So these algorithms don't tell you everything there is to know, but they can sometimes rule out certain models and say, oh, this model's fine-tuned for your data, doesn't do a good job of explaining the conditional independence relations.
Rob,
yeah?
Shouldn't it say latent permitting then?
Fine. Yes, it should.
Because you were talking about inequalities.
Except that, these algorithms tend to just return latent free DAGs. So I think you could run these algorithms and basically say, here are the latent free DAGs that could explain at least the conditional independence relations in my data. And then you could say, and some of those nodes now could actually be latent. I could say that, you know, once it gives me these latent free DAGs. No, sorry, maybe I'm misremembering. I think the right thing for me to say here is, at the moment, I don't recall whether the algorithms would return any DAGs that involve more variables. I think they do. I think this should say latent permitting, yeah. Because you get these patterns coming out of the algorithms, and those patterns have some undirected edges that really encode the presence of unobserved common causes. So yeah, I think I need to refresh my memory on exactly how the algorithm works, but I agree with you. I think they should say, what are all the latent permitting DAGs?
Yeah, I say that just because you're saying, maybe I misunderstood what you meant, but you're saying that the DAGs have the right deseparation relations, but they might fail to be compatible with the full distribution.
Yes.
That is because of inequality constraints.
Right.
And then you have to have latents.
Yes. Yes, you're right. Yes. Yeah, I garbled that. You're absolutely right. And now that I think about what these algorithms return, it really is a description of a latent permitting DAG in the most general case.
Okay.
So in the problem set, you're going to be looking at, you know, correlations that violate and correlations that satisfy Bell inequalities, and what sorts of conditional independence relation conditions they satisfy. And so you'll see something of, you know, how these algorithms can't tell you everything about causal discovery.
Yeah, this is a question too, the one about EPR and CGCH.
Right. Okay, so let me end with, just to complete the story about equality constraints, there's more than just conditional independence. So here's an example of a DAG due to Verma, which I could represent this way, or here's what the MDAG looks like. And it has a conditional independence relation. So A is independent of C given B. So if I look at all the paths from A to C, there's only one. It's the one that goes through B. So conditioning on B makes them independent. There's no way of getting to C. There's another path to C, which is this one. But I'm not conditioning on D, so that path is blocked as well. So A is independent of C given B. But it turns out that's not the only constraint on the joint distributions over these four variables. There's another type of constraint. And so I want to try to explain to you what that is. So say I write down the expression for the joint distribution in terms of this latent variable mu. So I just, it's the product of every variable given its parents, and then I marginalize over mu. So D depends on mu and C. So that's this bit here. C depends on B. B depends on A and mu. A has no parents, mu has no parents. And then I notice that only certain terms here depend on mu. So I've organized them all together here, colored them red. And then I also noticed that this is a expression for a conditional probability BD given AC, and it's the conditional probability that I would get for this hypergraph. So if I look at this hypergraph and I have what kinds of joint distributions over BD given AC could I hope to see here, the answer would be, well, take the probability of D given its parents, which are C and mu. That's this term. Take the probability of B given its parents, A and mu. That's this term. And then, of course, multiply by the probability of mu and marginalize over mu. So that's this here. So what I've shown is that the joint distribution for this graph here can be factorized into this form, where a term in this factorization is exactly a distribution that's compatible with this other DAG, this subgraph of this one, where I've dropped the arrow from B to C. Okay, so now I can ask, well, are there any extra constraints on that distribution? And it turns out, well, this graph has some D separations of its own. So in this graph, D is independent of A given C. So if I look at the path between D and A, if I condition on C, that's fine. The path is still blocked because I'm not conditioning on B. So A and D are D separated marginally, but also conditional on C. And that wouldn't be true here, right? Because if I'm ignoring B up here, I would induce by the collider here correlations between A and D. Conditioning on C wouldn't stop that. It wouldn't block this path between A and D. So this is an independence that holds down here but wouldn't hold up here. But it's certainly an independence that means that, you know, the joint distribution over A, B, C, D in this graph, it's marginal on D, has to have this form. So I can think of this as a constraint on this Q. So I have an equality constraint on this QBD given AC. And I know that QBD given AC can be rewritten in terms of the P's, right? If I just take this product and I divide both sides of this equation by that product, I can write the Q's in terms of those guys. So if I have an equality constraint on the Q's, I also have an equality constraint on these guys. And these guys, they're just a complicated polynomial expression of the joint probability distribution, the parameters in the joint probability distribution. So at the end of the day, I have a new equality constraint on the parameters in the joint probability distribution, which isn't just following, it isn't just a conditional independence in the original graph. Okay.
Just D separated from A, even if you didn't condition on C?
True. But I want a constraint on this guy here, this QBD given AC. And so this constraint allows me to say that the marginal on, like if I marginalize over B and I look at Q of D given AC, I know it has this special form. So that allows me to write an equality constraint for the thing I'm interested in. So not all of the things that you have will necessarily turn into equality constraints back on the original distribution that you're interested in. Okay, so this new type of equality constraint is called the Verma constraint. And so after Verma did this work, people realized how to generalize this. Here's another example. So I have a graph, which as I showed in the last, it looks like this as an MDAG. So I have these three guys are acted on by a common cause, these two guys are acted on by a common cause. And I can do the same trick. I can say, all right, let me write out just the product of every variable given its parents. And notice that A, C, and E are the only ones that depend on lambda. That's the blue here. And the others, B and D, are the only ones that depend on mu. That's the one in red. And hang on just a sec. I can write each of those now as a conditional probability, the Q's. And then I find that this Q, the red one, is compatible, like we saw before, with this graph where I've now dropped the arrow from B to C and eliminated E altogether. So it's just B and D, which are the ones that were common cause connected, condition on their parents in the original graph. And the other one, A, C, and E, is just A, C, and E together with their parents. That's what's compatible with this guy. And so then I can ask, do these guys have equality constraints? You know, this is just the Verma guy again. This is something new. But it turns out that this guy also has conditional independence relations that hold, which then imply equality constraints on this. And I have my old equality constraints on that. So I can sort of fold those in, find new equality constraints on the joint distribution. So here's the most general form, that if I have something like this, where now a given node can appear in multiple, have multiple different common causes acting on it. So like this guy's part of the blue and the red hyperedge. This guy's part of the green and the red hyperedge, and so on. This is where the nesting comes in. So I can do the same thing I did before, rewrite the joint distribution, and notice that it splits up into these two, what are called districts. So A, C, D, and E are a district because they're all ultimately connected by some common cause pathway. I can always find some steps through the common causes that'll connect A, C, D, and E, whereas B is not connected to any of them by a common cause. So I organize things into these different districts. I can write things out in terms of a conditional of a district given its parents. So B is a district, its parent is A, B has parent A, A, C, D, E is a district, its parent is B. And then for each one of them, I can say, all right, find the subgraph that it's compatible with, find all the constraints on it. So in this case, there's an extra D separation relation. That gives me an inequality constraint. But then there's a next step. And this is sort of the end of the discussion of the general thing. So in addition to these kinds of constraints, I can now say, take this guy, the subgraph, and notice that if I marginalize over A, so A has no children here. It did back in the original graph, but now in this subgraph, it has no children. If I marginalize over him, that's not going to do anything. I'm not conditioning on him. I'm not inducing correlation to his parents. I'm just marginalizing over him. So that just leaves C with some extra noise, D with some extra noise. So all that's left is this omega common cause. And so after marginalizing over A, I get a conditional that's compatible with a new subgraph. It's just the Verma graph again. So it has a special decomposition. I've called it this extra term R. R has some equality constraints, which I can pull back into the ratio of this Q to those Qs. And then that means that I have equality constraints on this. And I can go back to turn them into equality constraints on this thing, which turns into equality constraints on that thing. So you sort of see how it's this nesting procedure. You find the districts. Each district is compatible with a subgraph of the original graph. You go to that graph. You look if you know there's any variables that have no children that I can marginalize over. I get a new subgraph. And every time I can go looking for new equality constraints, ultimately I can rewrite all those back in terms of the original probability distribution. So these are called nested Markov constraints. I think I already defined what a district was. Maybe I'll just make it clear before I give you the general definition of the algorithm. Here I have three districts. B, D is a district. A is a district. C is a district. Here I have two districts. B, D and A, C, E is another district. Here I have just the two, the one A, C, D, and E, which are all connected, and B. So the algorithm tells me, go find all the districts within your DAG. The full distribution factorizes into conditionals of districts given their parents. Demand that each factor satisfy any equality constraints implied by D separation in the subgraph that you associate to each of those districts. Then go find the childless variable in that subgraph. Identify the new subgraph of it that you obtain by eliminating that variable. And then look for any equality constraints on that, which means repeating this whole algorithm over and over again in a nested fashion. And what Robin Evans and others were able to show is that this will get you all the equality constraints that hold on your joint distribution.
Is it also needed? So it's, if you have a childless variable, before marginalizing over that, you have to also see what the constraints are and then marginalize?
Yeah.
Okay. There is a proof for this, right?
This paper has the proof that this will give you all the equality constraints that hold. So for a long time, people focused just on the conditional dependence relations. So people in the causal inference community focused mostly on conditional dependence, writing algorithms that would leverage that. This is sort of relatively more recent, all the equality constraints. But I would say it's not the thing that quantum physicists have focused most on. We've focused most on inequality constraints. But what has been shown is that even when you make some of your latent variables quantum, not only do all the conditional independence relations that you used to have among your observed variables for classical models, so they go through for the quantum latent models, but so do these nested Markov conditions. Okay, so all the equality constraints that hold in causal models with classical latents, those equality constraints also hold when you make the latents quantum. But it's the inequality constraints, they're the only ones that distinguish the classical for the quantum. So they're the place where you really see the difference, where you have a chance of witnessing quantumness. But you know, if all you care about is causal discovery in a classical context, you know, the distinction between inequalities and inequalities is not as significant, and you want to avail yourself of every chance you have of detecting the causal structure. Okay, so that's it for today, and next time we'll talk about inequality constraints. Any questions? I should say that I'm describing these algorithms kind of with a very light touch, because I don't expect you to want to be like coding these things. You can always go to the paper. What I'm mostly focused on is just giving you some intuition for how the different techniques work, so that you kind of have a flavor for what sorts of constraints there are. So for example, in the nested Markov case, if it's not clear exactly, you know, exactly how do you find all the conditions, go to the paper. You know, there's very clear definitions there. But hopefully you sort of get a flavor for what the opportunities are based on these simple examples.
Sorry, did you say something about a workshop before?
Yeah, so in April, middle of April, we're having a workshop here, which is going to bring together quantum physicists who work on causal inference and some of the statisticians who do. And yeah, it's probably, I think the talks are going to be about whatever anyone wants to talk about, but strictly speaking, the focus is supposed to be on models where the cardinality of these latent variables is known. So leveraging your knowledge of, you know, the cardinality of some of the latent variables, even if you haven't observed them. Because our thought was that there's some tools in quantum information theory and quantum foundations called dimension witnesses, where sometimes you can look at a pattern of correlations you've seen in a Bell-type experiment and work out what the dimensions of the quantum systems are. And that's the quantum analog of sort of learning something about the cardinality of some of your latent variables. And so it seemed to us that maybe some of those quantum ideas could lead to new classical techniques. And maybe some of the classical techniques could give us new ideas about witnessing dimensions in quantum theory. So hopefully there'll be a little bit of that going on at the workshop. But I suspect it'll also be just a lot of talks won't be focused on that, and will be more general.